With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, this is Peter Joseph, and you're listening to V Radio.
Hello, guys, and welcome to this edition of V Radio. Today is another one of my new shows, although we do kind of have a focus. There is one thing that's, you know, it's kind of a continuation of stuff that I've been talking about on previous shows. I do actually plan to do a more structured blog that I'll probably put on the Zeitgeist Movement newsletter and perhaps submit to some of the other articles I've been offered to run the People's Tribune and a couple of other places that go out to activists. So, first, let me introduce my guests. Today I have with me Ben McLeish. Is that how you say your name?
That's right, sir. It is indeed. Thank you for having me, Neil.
You have been on before. I just wanted to be sure I didn't butcher your name. And Rick Powell, who some of you may remember from some of my YouTube videos before, as well as a great radio show. Ray?
Hi, Neil.
And also Chris, also known as Meme Filter.
Hi, Neil. How you doing?
Not too bad. Today I wanted to talk about a few different topics. I've given you guys some of it based on some articles. I'm also going to be playing some recordings. But the first thing that I wanted to bring up as far as conversation is concerned is, like, I was thinking this morning as I was making my breakfast about a severe contrast, I guess is the word I would use, between the way that the two quote-unquote 9/11 attacks were perpetuated. Now, I'm not discussing anything here. We're not going to get into conspiracy theory. That's not the point. It's more of a matter of we're going to talk about how the media treated the things. Right now, for example, Fox News is doing a really heavy job of trying to make it look like the Obama administration did something terrible as far as, you know, a total lack of security or not enough attention to security in the consulate in Libya. And what I found really ironic about it is I went back and and thought about different things that were brought up as far as, you know, any failures of security that were, you know, perpetuated in the original September 11th, 2001 attacks. And even just speaking to mainstream media here and not getting any questions about any of the other issues surrounding 9/11, I remember very distinctly that you weren't even allowed to discuss that, you know, there were security failures. And They went through all kinds of loops and crap to, in order to get, you know, Condoleezza Rice, for example, to finally get up and testify, about the, I think they were called, you know, PDBs or whatever from the CIA, saying Bin Laden determined to attack the United States, and how that information was given to the White House at the time. But the media did a really good job at that time of making it just like this sacrilege to ever even discuss the possibility of any failures on the part of the Bush administration when it came to security 9/11. But now it's all a big cover-up conspiracy by the Obama administration not to tell us about the truth of, you know, the supposed security failures on 9/11. I'm going to do, as I said, a more detailed report on this, but I was kind of curious just to get you guys' perspectives on this subject. Just the fact that it seems interesting that the media will embrace the idea of a failure in security when it benefits them and, you know, kind of toss it aside when it doesn't. I'll start with you, Ben.
Well, I mean, it's always interesting to see how the media is essentially just this sort of Robert Greenwald really recently put it with the Koch brothers exposed. It essentially just is this echo chamber of whatever you're allowed to speak about. It really isn't a reflection of anything other than this bizarre soapboxing by those who are in power. I know that I can only really relate this most easily to when Tony Blair was Prime Minister in the UK. Obviously, I'm a Brit, as you can hear from my voice, hopefully. And very often there were just newspaper articles everywhere in London that just carried, for example, the newspaper title, "We Will Be Bombed." He would just say, "Blair, we will be bombed." That was it. And he must be party to some information that we all didn't have other than himself. in which case one would hope he would also have acted upon it. So there's this tremendous fear that runs through all of it, and a fear that I think ultimately really does solidifies further these sort of artificial national boundaries that we've come to expect and what we identify as being part of our own identity, our national identity. So that's certainly what I've seen. I was lucky enough to be in LA in 2011 for September the 11th, 10 years on. And it's very telling to see how the media chose to reflect that just even then. It was just over and over again the usual talking points about terrorism and the disastrous danger you might be in. Never really does it ever get talked about that real failure of security that anybody might expect, whether it's in Libya, whether it's anywhere, is down to what you choose as a nation or what comes about by the inaction of nations that promotes these kinds of behaviors. It's very telling to see that the nations that don't have massive attacks like this, the very, very far northern Europe and Scandinavian areas come to mind, particularly, with this kind of thing. So it's obviously not a universal thing that happens. So I always think to myself, it's a shame that that never gets talked about, the real security actually be the whole point of these things not occurring in the first place, that, those situations should really be everything that we're pursuing and not the bizarre, draconian, opportunistic way in which we just let them happen.
Yeah, I definitely think you put a lot of good stuff in there, and it's interesting to hear the perspective from England, and I guess that kind of brings me to another question for you before we switch to another panelist. What is the news coverage on the issue of this stuff that happened in Libya in England? How are you touching on it there with the BBC?
Well, the first thing that was noted was when I was listening to it, I was actually drinking a lot at the time, so I heard broad European coverage of it. It wasn't immediately obvious to us, or at least from what I'd heard, that it was a parallel of 9/11 at all, and that it might have been informed not just by some bizarre reactment or some kind of harking back to the original attacks, but that it was also to do with the this awful film that made The Innocence of Muslims, and that was partly to do with that, and then it was well known it was planned anyway, and it came up at that point. So a lot of it was a tiny bit more even-handed than I'd imagine it would have been by people like Fox News. None of it really, at least as far as I can see, and I'd have to plead ignorance on here, ever blamed the Obama administration for not being good enough. That wasn't really a talking point over here because, of course, there's nothing to be gained from that. We can't vote for Obama, so it just doesn't become a thing that's talked about. Which is very telling. It then really gives you a clue as to why that is talked about in America. These things sort of opportunized into political capital, if you like. So that's as much as I saw from it then. It was very much more subtle. Oh, it could be this film. Other than that, no, it could have been a little bit earlier. And probably was, to be honest, a combination of both. I think. We're a little bit more even-handed with that, but we're way less even-handed with national security issues of our own when it gets put in the papers, because, of course, we do actually have the political capital to be gained from presenting a piece of news in a certain way.
It's interesting, actually. There are a lot of great documentaries that come out of the BBC, and it didn't occur to me that one of the reasons why European news, I often am like, wow, it seems like European news is more reliable. And then when you ask the Europeans, they're like, no, that's not true, And then you just kind of pointed it out, is that there's really no motivation to spin news about what's going on in the United States, at least not as anywhere near as much as might be what's going on locally. But one of the reasons I keep chuckling is because they're trying to make this Libya thing now to be an organized Al-Qaeda operation. And after watching The Power of Nightmares, the BBC Adam Curtis documentary that kind of debunks the entire myth of Al-Qaeda, not that there is no Al-Qaeda necessarily, but just that they're far smaller than we've ever been led to believe here in the United States. My mouth was open when I was watching that documentary because I was like, wow, I can't believe anybody just put the exposure on this. And then they put a lot of attention on the neoconservatives, who are kind of have a vested interest in inflating the Al-Qaeda thing. And it, you know, you just kind of laid out for me, I think, why it might even be to discuss from a third party perspective, you know, the news, you know, as far as, you know, maybe, you know, even news outlets outside of the country might be better as far as lack of in for your own country's news. So
that's right. And in fact, you've actually named one of my favorite documentaries there. I mean, the whole tying back and sort of genesis of all of those ideas back to Leo Strauss is extremely important. And this is the other thing you have to remember with, I mean, when that was shown, which I'm guessing like 2005, around then, something like that, we had such few terrestrial TV stations. Now, obviously, we've all made the jump to digital, and we all have 8,000 channels of iPod commercials. But, you know, back then, really, just 4 or 5 channels. And so having all three parts of that shown on one of the 5 channels, in other words, a fifth of the mostly available media, was a huge effect, and still is to these days. I mean, since McSweeney's, who was run by, I forgot the name now, one of my favorite guys, McSweeney's actually republished those DVDs and gave them out free with their Wolf in DVD magazine. That's an American outfit that did that. So it has spread hugely, and I would hope with it some understanding of the slightly more complicated sort of geopolitical and historical roots of what it means to demonstrate and personify terrorism in respect to a sort of a national body of people.
Right, and that's, you know, the only thing I feel is difficult about trying to get people to watch that is that it doesn't get to the super meat until, like, near the end of part 2 and then in part 3, you know, like when they're exposing that bin Laden, the video that so many people have seen of him walking around with this group of terrorists was that those guys were actually paid actors who were said, hey, take this AK-47 and put on a ski mask and follow him around. We need to make this Al-Qaeda thing look really big so we can get the world in on it, you know. And that's, you know, it got to the point where I was laughing. Like, it's not funny, but I was laughing, yeah. You know, because of how ridiculous it was that we were so duped with this stupidity. But, all right, I'm going to move on to you, Ray. What is your impression?
Well, you know, you've asked me, and, you know, it was interesting because you're trying to focus on the media spin, and that's definitely an important topic. But, you know, I don't know any of the media spin because I don't pay any attention to the media whatsoever, like zero. As a matter of fact, I was so proud to announce last night on my Facebook that I had no idea there was a presidential debate last night, and truly am really, really glad that I am unaware of these things. It makes me feel like I really am. It makes me feel like I really am living in a world of reality where I'm not being programmed and not being distracted by this nonsense. And
what's a president?
What?
I said, what's a president? Mm-hmm. Talk about being disconnected.
Oh.
yeah, right? The latest, right, the latest puppet. But, my take on this embassy thing, well, you just, I've heard little bits about it. I didn't know what happened on 9/11, and I didn't know that that there was a big deal being made about it in the media. So that's all new information. Now, for me, I
have to answer the phone. So we'll go to Chris, and go ahead and mute yourself, Ray.
Okay.
Incoming. I thought Ben nailed it, really, and you can see it in the dichotomy of American versus foreign markets. While we are talking about media, there's, and I'm going to come back to this a lot on your show, aren't I? How economics, and when you're talking to an audience that understands economics and advanced economics especially, it's the best, if not the best, a very good way to analyze what's really going on. And foreign media markets have very little incentive to report the American slant on things. And if you look why, you can say because the American slant is funded by dollars. And then you get into the relationship of why various parties, and remember, you got MSNBC, CNN, and all these people, they appear to be fighting with each other, and maybe they are. But they're doing it after fact to an event they didn't really expect coming, because it was arguably not, if it was organized, probably wasn't organized by the typical Al-Qaeda, which loves to send out their messages on YouTube, don't we know?
Right.
So, on something like 9/11, all eyes immediately turned, and I don't know if people knew it was coming or not, but they shut their mouths and stopped trying to put a political spin on it for the most part. Not so on this case. Immediately the American incentives, the factions get to work trying to blame Obama. It's nice that it happened in an election cycle. And I'm sure somewhere in Singapore is a journalist going, I cannot believe the American audience buys this.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think that we've definitely, you know, covered a lot of good ground on this. And overall, I generally kind of try to tell people that it comes back to something that Ben Stewart, the maker of Chimatic and Esoteric Agenda, said. I keep talking about this one thing that he pointed out in one of his videos for his Hangman project, which is kind of his movement that he's putting together. And it was that even when the United States supposedly was freed from the monarchy, they did not really perceive or truly understand or grasp the concept of free. Like, their initial reaction was, oh, okay, so we're going to make George Washington the king now, right? You know, and it goes far beyond just the issue of their understanding human governance or the other options that were presented to them. It was also just that people don't necessarily understand all of the responsibility that goes into being free. And I guess for me now, and I've been trying to figure out a way to coalesce all of these thoughts that I've had and figure out a way to express it, you know, without repeating myself too much. But it's basically that I look around, like, you know, the other day I was talking to a lady, you know, in a restaurant, and she was talking to me about why she supported Romney. And, you know, it came to a point in the conversation where I realized, okay, we are now to the point that I'm not going to get through to her. She's never going to listen to me. You know, and so I just kind of politely nodded and smiled and let her continue. And it just occurred to me that, you know, I even gave her a couple of things to look at. You know, like, did you watch the 47% video? Did you watch, you know, the stuff? You know, it's especially when you spit out the elephants in the room. And that'll be a good segue in my portion of today's show, just to be talking about how the debates went, is that, you know, I pointed out, well, you know, so Obama, you know, didn't lower unemployment as much as he said, but you do realize that the president actually doesn't really have as much control over unemployment as you might think, that most unemployment is caused by companies like Romney's outsourcing to third world countries or automating their jobs. And she kind of looked at me blank for a moment and then just went on talking because she didn't want to face that. And for the most part, even mainstream politicians don't face that. And there was only one time when I was watching the debates last night that I could even say that I was, you know, cheering, essentially, was like, I just spent the whole debate angry that they kept saying, create jobs, create jobs, create jobs. We're going to create jobs, create jobs, create jobs. Like I've said on so many other episodes of V Radio, no politician is going to be willing to do what's necessary to create jobs. And most of them don't really want to talk about why there are no jobs. They will feed you the trickle-down economic theory that if you cut taxes to the rich, that will somehow create jobs. The problem is that that's already been done. It was done by Bush in his 4 years as president. And, oh, lo and behold, look at this. We have this huge unemployment rate, you know, because everything's getting outsourced overseas. People don't want to talk about that. And they even have hot-button ways of making it not okay to talk about that. In the same way it was not okay to talk about security failures for 9/11, is to say, oh, are you racist? You know, do you hate the Chinese people? Do you hate the Mexicans? Do you hate the people in India and Bangladesh? Is that why you're talking about outsourcing? You know, those people need jobs too. And I was just like, okay. I'm just trying to demonstrate to you realistically that it's impossible for us to maintain an economy when we send all of our jobs overseas. You know, and they don't want to talk about that, you know, obviously. And it's this elephant in the room. I mean, an elephant. No, it's not an elephant. It's a blue whale in the room about what's really going on with jobs and where they're going and how, in many cases, I mean, they're not going back, which is why I was surprisingly relieved last night when Obama said many of the jobs are not coming back and finally spit out that a lot of it is due to outsourcing and jobs going overseas. And he finally spelled that Romney's company actively outsources. You know, that's not even something that you have to just for spin to find. He said it in his own words, the alleged 47% video. The state's just about the 47% of the people who vote for him were only part of it. The part where he's describing, you know, have you seen these sweatshops that these can, you know, I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but you can get the exact quotes. I actually did a whole show about that video, which you guys can find in the archives. You know, he describes in detail how the ladies work you know, for his company in these sweatshop labor, you know, situations where you pack like 10 women into a little room and you put up barbed wire fences and guard towers to be sure people don't sneak in and try to work, you know. And that's exactly what, you know, and like when he's saying things like, I want us to be more attractive employers, but I want people to come back to America. I'm like, okay, so you're going to eliminate minimum wage, eliminate basic standards for workers. You're going to eliminate overtime. You're going to eliminate benefits. You're going to eliminate, you know, all basically everything that is, you know, that the labor movement accomplished, you know, because and that's the silly thing about the whole thing. When they tell you they're going to create jobs, when they tell you they're going to fix the economy, and they don't address the basic concept that the reason we don't have any and the reason we're not going to get any is because companies are going to places where they can essentially hire people who will work for, you know, will work in a lifestyle that is as good or worse than plantations, you know, on the, you know, these slave plantations in early United States. You know, nobody wants to talk about that. And it got touched on just a little bit, you know, by Obama during the debate last night. And I honestly still don't think he's going to do anything to fix it either. Don't get me wrong. But it's interesting to me how little people will talk about that. And the only guy I know who would was the independent Lou Dobbs. Lou Dobbs talked about outsourcing constantly, so much to the point that it actually, you know, like it's one of the reasons I'm pretty sure the mainstream wanted to get rid of him, because he didn't shut up about it because nobody else was talking about it. You know, and basically, you know, and then Ben, I'm going to kind of segue into this. You know, it's interesting to me that they do talk about some of the symptoms, but the ones that are the most glaringly obvious as to why we're in the economic situation that we're in just get glossed over. I mean, I doubt there's, I mean, like, I don't know much about England's economy, but do you guys have an outsourcing situation over there?
Actually, I was about to relate to you a story I got from last week. I met a man who produces very beautiful blank paper books, books you can just sort of write in, a little bit like those Moleskine books. And he said he was Canadian. He said he was actually insourcing from China to Canada. And I said, well, how are you doing? And he said the one thing that's absolutely true. He said, automation is the only way I can do it. He said, I'll bring it back. It saves on the delivery cost, also somewhat saves on the fact that I'm, you know, contributing to the burning of a massive amount of hydrocarbons by moving mega tankers around that are bringing all this stuff from China or elsewhere. But ultimately, I'll be insourcing and I'll be automating. Now, why is that? Well, obviously, the first reason being, if you drop the dependence on labor, you also drop your dependence upon having to pay a wage. And of course, then you make your products cheap enough to be able to sell back into an economy that has become used to an almost artificial low level of cost for items that have been either produced by extreme slave labor or that were produced through automation to begin with. So even the insourcing is actually a complete lie, basically. It's not going to produce more jobs. What it'll do is produce things closer to you for you to buy with less jobs. And so that's something I found entertaining. I didn't talk too much about what I do. I was on a work trip, and I tend to be stealth in that mode. I just try and sneak the idea in. But England's economy, well, let's have a look at us. We're a small island. We used to run the world. Neil and everyone else, do you mind giving us our colleagues back, please?
No, you can't have them. We're extra. Sorry, go on.
No, that's fair enough. That's fair enough. In fact, one of the greatest that ever is the American independence. But, you know, we've got a dilemma here. We have a very small landmass. We have quite a big population for the landmass that we inhabit. I mean, Germany, around 80 million people, and is much bigger than we are. We're much smaller with something like 60 million people, I think, last time I checked. A great deal was agriculture, but the common European market means that we've ended up importing a lot of cheap stuff. And, I mean, now I walk around the supermarket, every single grown item is from Argentina or from somewhere else. We're a very big importer nation, and we rely, instead of being a massive exporter nation, not really that big on export, the huge part of our economy, or at least a sizable chunk of it that walks against this, is that we're essentially a service economy. Or at least we were until clever phone automation and voice recognition and call centers in India meant that suddenly our services actually could be outsourced live throughout the day, whether I'm calling my bank. And so it's had somewhat of an effect there. Having said that, our employment as of yesterday just dropped to, I think it's like 5 million people or something. Now, I haven't looked into why it is, but I'd imagine it's probably because like the trick that Walmart likes to do. It creates jobs that they call full-time jobs that are 15 hours a week. It might be down to something like that, or it might be some tendential small thing, but the overall trend is not a good one, and especially if you align our unemployment numbers to count for those who have stopped seeking work, which is a trick that we learned from you in the early 90s. So it's we have the same pressures, but add to that, we don't have the land mass of the U.S. We were originally service, and we've ended up importing a little bit more than I think even you guys do, I think. I'm not sure.
Now, Chris, as far as the issue of discussing the concept of outsourcing and how it affects the economy and how it's the real cause of unemployment, what would you say?
Well, I think the real cause of unemployment has always been obsolescence, is that technology moves on and skills don't, and people end up losing their jobs. So people, you know, you could make a, for lack of a better word, a socialist argument that any state or nation should invest in the training of its brains for long-term viability. But I have an anecdote which sums it up, helps ties back to the debates pretty well, too. And let me say this, too. Before I get into that, the automated process isn't going to end, okay? People need to understand that the nature of jobs is shifting. You don't need to have – maybe there will be a boutique market for knife sharpeners, for really professional people who go and sharpen knives by hand for chefs in a crystal palace with, I don't know, red velvet or something like that. But most of it will be done by machine. Why? Because machines are better, they're faster, efficient, and they don't need to eat. You don't need to give maternity leave. So anything that can be replicated through automation is going to be so. And if you're in a manufacturing job, just, you know, lay down and die now because it's over. It's already gone. There's the last few things of tightening nuts and bolts left in the mechanical manufacturing market, unless you're in software and media. And you're just going to have to accept the reality that we don't need you to build cars anymore. So, Detroit, you can go to hell.
Right.
To bring that back around is an anecdote. I read a long time ago an analysis by an economist who was explaining how a publicly traded company like Microsoft has no incentive to publicize security flaws. This is crazy. Let's talk about Mitt Romney saying corporations are people. Okay, maybe they are. Maybe they're legal fictions and persons or something like that. But that doesn't mean they're smart. Everyone knows they're not ethical, right? They have a different thing called monetization. But that doesn't mean they're smart or good at it. And instead, you case like Microsoft in this one. The stock goes down anytime they report a bug. Anytime anyone says Microsoft security flaw found, the stock goes down. And that is antithetical to the purpose of the corporation. So the corporation has extremely strong incentive to hide every security flaw that happens, even though in publishing the security flaw, they get thousands of researchers to solve the problem. So Microsoft is, in effect, by its goal of being profitable in the stock market, is making an intentionally insecure product. And this is the same with the government, with the jobs report. Mitt Romney and Barack Obama have no interest in actually telling you where the jobs went, why, or what they're going to do about getting them back, because there's nothing they can do. But that's not what gets people to vote, and that's not what separates the blue team into the red team, where the people will sit and argue over the beers they continue to consume about where all the jobs went. As long as you're drunk and not noting, you won't care that your job is gone. You'll keep getting lottery tickets. But underneath all of this is the economic manifestation of why people choose. And the fact is it sells more votes. It sells more cars. It sells more knickknacks. Snacks, Doritos, if people just simply think that the Pavlov answer is true. You know, the CIA said a long time ago, when everything every American believes is false, we'll have done our jobs. And, you know, props to you, CIA, because you're well on your way. People think that jobs are created by politicians. It's crazy. But yet, there it is.
You know, and that kind of segues into a point that I wanted to make, that somebody's linking a photo that actually is really hilarious, and It's got a picture of Romney from the debate last night, and it says, spends 90 minutes claiming that he'd create jobs as president. Then the big closing statement, government does not create jobs. So he went on talking about how he's going to create these 12 million jobs or whatever. And then at the end, when he's arguing with Obama, like right at the very, very end, like the funny thing is it was actually something he said into the mic as the mic was being cut. Government does not create jobs. So he knows that he can't go before the audience and say that, you know, that government doesn't create jobs. The funny thing about this, and this kind of brings me back to one more thing I wanted to point out, was in 2008 here in the state of Michigan, because you brought up Detroit and the auto jobs, Romney won Michigan as far as Republicans were concerned, and he beat McCain. It was one of the states he beat McCain in. And the funny thing is, Romney lied. He said, no, we can get the jobs back. McCain told the truth and said the jobs aren't coming back. The auto industry is gone. You guys need to reform your state's economy around some other means of, you know, of making money. I mean, don't get me wrong, and by no means am I a McCain fan, but you get my point, was that it was ironic that, you know, McCain told the truth and therefore lost, because people are still clinging to this idea that, you know, that the government is going to be able to fix this situation for them. And the only way it's going to happen is to do a bunch of things that no politician is ever going to do. It would be suicide to go back to, say, tariffs, like the original Constitution had intended, was tariffs on goods created overseas under the understanding you have to protect your local manufacturers or your local economy dies. You know, it's very basic, simple stuff. You know, and at the same time in that debate, he said that he wanted to get hard on China, but then he wants to open free trade. You know, NAFTA, the ironically a thing, and, you know, don't get me wrong, this is both sides of the aisle problem, you know, is the reason we're in this situation in the first place. All of the quote-unquote free trade, and that's why we have cheap goods coming in from these places where people will work for nothing and basically be excellent producers. So first I'm going to ask, Ray, are you still there or are you back?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I'm waiting.
Yeah,
I'm
go ahead.
I'm ready to go here, buddy.
Okay, I just wanted to be sure. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, it seems to me that, you mentioned how a lot of people are listening to this information and kind of missing the real point. It seems that we're doing a lot of that here as well, because ultimately, you know, all this stuff, whether you're talking about the media spin on bombings or whether you're talking about the presidential debate, or more specifically, whether you're talking about what they said in that debate about creating jobs or not, we're all under this kind of paradigm as if it's okay that there is a class who has the ability to tell us that we have this thing called a job or not.
Sure.
Or that we ought to depend on them to buy such things. So in one effect, we're missing the personal responsibility effect of that, and that why you want or need a job is only a societal training thing. Every human is perfectly capable of walking out, digging in the dirt and growing some stuff and building themselves a shelter, we may be getting back to a point where that is the only kind of options we have, or that is a much more real option or a more real thing that's going to be facing people in life. I think that'll be an okay kind of thing, because largely what that's going to do is get us back on a real mindset again, in that we don't need anybody to create us a job. We don't even want their stupid job. What we want to do is live our lives and raise our families. And to the extent that technology enables our lives to become easier, technology is the thing also that we talk about that is, quote, killing the jobs.
Right.
So, I mean, we want technology. We want our lives to be easier. What the problem is that the efficiencies created through technology are not being shared among the populace. They're not, in other words, when new technology comes out that makes it easier to grow food, that makes a better building material for your homes, so you can keep a roof over your head, or that makes it easy for you to teach your children the things of the world that they ought to know. The technologies are all being implemented in ways that benefit an elite class and do not benefit the general populace. And, you know, when we start to rethink that situation, then we'll start to realize that all of these issues are really just herrings, and that that we can yell at each other till we're blue in the face about all this and not agree because we're not talking about anything that is really the root core. So, you know, getting back to that, restructuring the way we think about economics and society in general is probably where we're headed one way or the other. And, you know, things like employee-owned corporations are probably the way of the future. You know, we've talked about that at length. So then we do have technology and way of implementing things that do make life better. It is not going to be owned by guys who are friends with bankers who can print money out of thin air and then hire all the labor they need to implement their scheme. It's going to be implemented because people come together, decide that this is a good thing for their community or this is a good thing for their locality, largely, and their society in general, and that they'd like to have the benefits of this new technology, and that by working together we can achieve this technology. And in working together and creating an efficiency that is good for everybody, well, it's going to be shared by everybody, and that the employee owners of this company who are the specific ones to implement the technology, while they may have a special care and take in the implementation of new technology and maybe possibly have more to gain personally by the successful implementation of it through their system or the factory, largely they're also going to be making sure that they're not being overly greedy about it as well, that the efficiencies created through this new technology will benefit society as a whole. And I think that's a natural thing that will occur in an employee-owned corporation. And that's just one example of the many new ways of rethinking economics and politics that are definitely in our future.
For sure. Now, obviously, we've spent a good amount of time on this, so I don't want to spend too much longer on it because we have some other stuff to get to in this hour. But, you know, and that, I think, kind of brings us back to, you know, what a lot of the people in the Zeitgeist movement have been talking about, a lot of people just around the world. And I've suggested this to different anarchists, for example, that, you know, we've now come to a point where the system is going to fail inevitably. I don't bring up the job issue because I expect or believe that a politician is going to create jobs for me. It's mostly a matter of, I think, that people need to recognize that the paradigm is shifting in a position where the 1% they are labeled, you know, really have no vested interest in employing us. So we either need to find sustainable means, you know, by which to take care of ourselves or perish. That's just the way it is. And in so doing, we will take a lot of power away from them because right now, as it is, they are doing best to make us as dependent on them as consumers as possible. So I'm looking forward to moving towards for the future of that. So now I want to bring on, we're going to move on to a different topic. And I have to say, I was astonished. This was linked on Zeitgeist Movement Global today, that a local Fox News channel, Fox 19, made this really candid report on the actual nature of debates and how people get into them. Some of you might remember this from Peter Joseph's recent, actually, first episode of Culture and Decline about kind of the illusions of democracy. He talked about how people get into the debates. Now, why this is so important mostly has to do with the fact of understanding that this is the control of information. They don't want certain candidates to be heard. And there is now, however, a movement and a change in that direction. And I've reported on this before, and I still urge you guys to consider checking it out, even if you don't plan on voting, just to get an idea about what it is that's being actively excluded. And that brings me to a new piece of news about the free and equal debates that I've been telling you guys about that will be attended by Jill Stein of the Green Party, Gary Johnson of the Libertarian Party, the representative of the Constitution Party, and Rocky Anderson of the Justice Party, who you might have also heard of, you know, like once again on an episode of E-Radio, I interviewed the guy. Sounds great. And Larry King is going to moderate this debate. Not only is it going to be put up on Al Jazeera, as I reported on the previous episode, now Russia Today will be picking up the stream for this debate of third-party candidates. So that little piece of information being brought together on that, I mean, you know, it's really good, however, that these third-party candidates are starting to get mainstream attention. So I wanted to go ahead and play a clip here. This comes from the Fox clip that I was telling you about earlier. Now, it's important to point out, like, and I found this out actually when I was out at Occupy Detroit, because there were people who showed up in a Fox News van, and everybody at Occupy Detroit was very untrusting. They were afraid they were dealing with corporate Fox News. I went over and talked to the guy, and he pointed out that the majority of small Fox News conglomerates actually have very little oversight from the part of the corporate Fox News. It doesn't mean that you absolutely trust everything, but these people also, like, you know, I talked to the guy about the movie Outfoxed. He had seen it. totally agreed without Fox, Rupert Murdoch's war on journalism, and was out there with a rare opportunity to get, you know, Occupy Detroit, you know, and the word out. And ironically, I mean, he did a positive thing about us on the TV that day. So, you know, still have to be careful, but it's important to remember that some of the people, a lot of the people at these stations are real people, just like you and me, you know, who aren't sucked into some corporate cult. So that being said, I'm going to get to this posting here that I saw earlier. You can get the links to this on my stuff, my Facebook, and we will get from there.
We carried it live as President Obama and Governor Mitt Romney held their first of three presidential debates. But one local teacher was surprised to find out with her students recently that these two men aren't the only two running for president. So why are there only two candidates debating? Ben has the reality check. You won't see anywhere else.
The email I received was from Karen, a computer teacher at Queen of Peace Elementary School. Karen's working with sixth graders on a poster project about the campaign. Quote, I'm having the students research the candidates, finding facts, developing the campaign poster, and then voting on election day. We did an early voting experience yesterday before they did any research. I then found a website that listed all of the candidates that were running. And surprise to everyone, there is more than Romney and Obama running. Well, Karen's right on. There are more candidates running. In fact, here in Ohio, there are at least 9 candidates on the ballot. Aside from the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, the Libertarian Party, the Constitution Party, the Green Party, even the modern-day Whig Party. So the question, why, if we're not a two-party country, do we have debates that include candidates from only major parties? Well, the answer is actually pretty simple. It's something called the Commission on Presidential Debates. The CPD was established in 1987. According to its website, its mission is to ensure that debates, as a permanent part of every general election, provide the best possible information to viewers and listeners. Well, what a noble mission. But it begs the question, if the goal is to provide the best possible information to viewers and listeners, how can you do that with only two candidates being given time to speak? You do have to have some criteria, though, don't you? Well, of course. And the CPD has 3 criteria. In order to be included, a candidate, number 1, must meet the constitutional requirements to be elected president. Understandable. Why allow someone to debate if they can't legally become president? Number 2, they must be on the ballot in enough states to win the Electoral College. Again, understandable. If a candidate cannot mathematically win, there's no reason to put them in a national debate. But then there's number 3. They must have received at least 15% support in 5 national polls. Well, that one is much less reasonable. But that 15% support rule is fairly new. In fact, how the CPD came into existence is pretty interesting. In 1976, 1980, and 1984, the League of Women Voters moderated presidential debates. They then walked away from it, saying that the demands of the two parties, Republican and Democrat, would perpetuate a fraud on the American people. The CPD, the Commission on Presidential Debates, as we know it today, was then formed by the Republican and Democrat parties. The commission is headed up by Frank Fahrenkamp, a former head of the Republican National Committee, and former Clinton White House Press Secretary Michael D. McCurry. So let's be clear, a debate commission that's run by former bigwigs from the Republican and Democrat parties and creates a 15% polling rule in 5 national polls isn't trying to create inclusion, they're trying to prevent it. If you don't have the money of the two big parties getting your name out nationally to get into those polls, well, it can only happen if you're a billionaire like Ross Perot. Aside from billionaires, no one else has a chance. This lack of inclusion is finally getting some attention, though. This year's debates, which are funded by sponsors, just lost 3 of their 10 sponsors, Philips Electronics, BBH New York, and the YWCA. They have all pulled their sponsor money because of the lack of inclusion of one particular candidate, Libertarian candidate and former New Mexico Governor Gary Johnson. Governor Johnson is the next highest polling candidate after President Obama and Governor Romney. But when he is included in polling, the effect he's having is significant. For instance, on Wednesday, Gravis Marketing and Capital Correspondent released results from Ohio from a poll conducted September 21st through the 22nd. That poll included 594 likely voters, and it covered the presidential race and the Senate elections. Take a look. In that poll, Obama-Biden, 45%. Other or unsure, 10%. Romney-Ryan, 44%. But then Gary Johnson's name was added, and here's how the numbers shook out then. Johnson, 10%. Obama-Biden, 44%. Other unsure, 7%. Romney-Ryan, 37%. So what you need to know, the fastest growing segment of the American electorate, independent voters. 43% of undecided swing voters are independents, and it's all about trajectory. Independent voters have been on the rise, while the parties have been playing to a shrinking base. There are now six states where independents outnumber both Republicans and Democrats. And that growing segment of the population isn't looking for fewer options. They're looking for more. This election could be an historic last for the control of this two-party system. And that is Reality Check.
If you'd like to make your voice heard on the story, head over to Ben's Facebook page. Find it by searching Ben Swan, WXIX.
So I'm really sorry about any sound problems that were on that clip. I basically had to upload an MP3 to Blog Talk Radio, and for whatever reason, I've been having sound trouble with them every now and then, and I'm going to call them up and deal with that. So I apologize, although it sounded like it was still completely legible. But basically, he just laid it out. He laid out that the debates are controlled by a commission that is headed up by one Republican and one Democrat, you know, both of which are former bigwigs in their parties. And so, yeah, obviously, it's not really in their vested interest to see third-party candidates, you know, included. Exclusion of candidates in a debate is known to be a typical tactic, okay? Like, when I ran for Congress in the 10th District of Michigan against Candace Miller, you know, I became friends with a Democratic candidate who did show up to all the debates, including the ones with only third-party candidates. And Candace Miller just flat-out refused to debate him ever, because she had nothing to gain. She had such a strong lead in her district that, you know, actually getting an opportunity to be held accountable for the things that she was doing was not really to her benefit. So then you run into a situation that basically kind of amounts to, you know, once again, control of information, control of the flow of information. You know, and when it comes to stuff like this, another reason why debates are important, and I think that any activist, including those who are not interested in voting, should take a note, is that the reason why many of us are even here is because of people like, for example, Congressman Ron Paul. Now, I know that a great deal of my listeners don't agree with Congressman Ron Paul's, you know, views on a lot of things, but on the same token, he is the reason that we even know about Federal Reserve. The 2008 election that he participated in brought a lot of attention to the Federal Reserve and a lot of attention to a lot of other things. I would have not even have heard of Zeitgeist if it was not for Ron Paul, because a lot of the parts of Zeitgeist 1 and the talks about the Federal Reserve were central to that. And that led to me, because those recommended me by a lot of Ron Paul people during the 2008 campaign. That led to me watching Addendum and obviously moving forward and being involved as I am in what I'm doing now. The reality is that participation in the debates is a great way to spread out, you know, information. And that kind of brings me back to what I said in my very first article for the Zeitgeist newsletter when we put it out, was use the political system as a soapbox. It's an angle that you can do to create real change. You know, yeah, we're not going to get a resource-based economy to happen overnight with it, but as Socialist Party candidate Brian Moore said on my show many years ago, a great deal of the differences that you see in the Democratic Party were accomplished because at one time the Socialist Party was making a big splash. They had all of the labor behind them, all the workers behind them, and the Democrats realized that they either had to change to accommodate a lot of the views that were expressed by the Socialist Party, or they were going to lose votes to the Socialist Party. You know, does that suddenly mean that's the way to handle it? No, it isn't. And that's why I voiced my own personal opinion that it would probably be, if you want to do a protest vote, to consider voting for the Green Party, just because their platform is very close to a lot of the things we espouse in the Zeitgeist movement. But that is, again, my opinion and not an official stance of the Venus Project or the Zeitgeist movement. Although Peter and Jacques Fresco have both acknowledged the benefits of using the political system as a soapbox. So now we've talked a little bit about, you know, obviously we exposed a little bit here about how the debates work, who gets into the debates, who does not get into the debates, and what motives of the, you know, essentially the collective media, you know, would have to doing this. And, you know, I mean, we've seen, for example, like way back in 2008, you know, they control it beyond the debates. I still remember the video of a Fox News guy intentionally telling his cameraman, okay, yeah, I don't want you to film any of these Ron Paul people over here. There was like 30 Ron Paul people standing there with signs, very excited, very happy. Turn the camera over here to the Giuliani people and, you know, maybe get some of those Romney people. Like, they were intentionally going out of their way to be sure that, you know, Ron Paul did not get any exposure. They do the same thing on both sides of the aisle. They went out of their way to marginalize my friend Mike Gravel, marginalize Congressman Kucinich. You see it in the amount of time that people get to talk during debates. I think it was actually during the documentary The Corporation. They did kind of a a stop-motion collection to show you just how long each candidate was allowed to speak in the debates. And Mike got like 5 minutes, and Kucinich got like 6 minutes, and Hillary got 30 out of an hour debate. How you can ever explain that math? You know, it's half the debate was Hillary talking, you know, without it being in some way on purpose. This is just ridiculous. You don't see it quite as much when you have only two people on the podium, but by that point, they've already marginalized your choices and the kind of ideas you're going to be exposed to. So, and that kind of brings me also just to ask, like, the English perspective. So, Ben, what are the debates like in England when you're seeing, like, the Labour Party, and I'm going to forget the don't you guys just call it, like, go ahead.
So we've got the Labour Party, which speaks to a point you were bringing up, like voting for the Greens and whatever. And voting, I mean, we have the Green Party over here as well. We have precisely exactly one seat in Parliament for the Green Party, so that's great. The Germans have more because for some reason, in their genetics almost, in their country's thinking, they very much take the environment very seriously and always have. But can you hear me okay?
Yeah, you sound fine.
Okay, fantastic. Yeah, we call them the Conservatives. There's also the Liberal Democrats, who were never really, for a very long time, in the limelight, except as to be a soundboard for mainstream policy, to argue with mainstream policy. But in 2010, they merged with the Conservatives in order to get into power, because there was not enough of the margin to be first past post. So now we actually have what we call a condemnation. A conservative democrat nation, and condemnation is valid for that too. What might surprise you, Neil, is that I had to check this before the show as well, because I couldn't quite believe it myself as an Englishman, is we have never had debates upcoming live on TV the way you have until 2010. That was the first time, and they are modeled very closely on the US format. So there are podiums, people stand, there's a live studio audience. They're a lot smaller, and they don't have quite as many fun graphics associated with them. But that's the first time we did it. Of course, our debates with politicians most regularly on TV. We have something called Question Time, where a lot of journalists and a lot of politicians go on, but they're not necessarily linked to upcoming elections. They're just something that's on almost every single night. So that I thought was rather interesting, is we tend to have paid for official events during which they speak, and only recently have introduced the idea of a head-to-head, literally vying for the top job sort of interview process, if you like. But it's very interesting. One thing I wanted to add, having watched last night's debate, or at least a portion of it, between Romney and Obama, is that it's very interesting to see not only that the talking points are obviously shrunk within the two particular parties that have been allowed to get in by the corporation that has essentially voted for them, but they had a head-to-head argument about fossil fuels, and nowhere was there anything about sustainable energy. Nothing. It wasn't actually a thing that is recognized, let alone even something to have a policy about. It's how did you treat the corporations that are drilling oil? Did you make them sit on, you know, was it they can sit on forever, 20 years, 10 years? It's all irrelevant. That stuff's running out, man.
Right.
It's a little bit like in some kind of weird playground game, becoming obsessed with one of the meaningless rules of a game that is not going to let you win overall anyway, but as long as you have it, you just sort of hold on to it. So I found that really bizarre, given the fact that I believe Arizona is actually building a phenomenally large solar array at the moment, and it might actually be phenomenally larger, were it actually a talking point, were it actually an attitude that you can have towards the environment, were it actually something that can be exposed, if you like, at this point, as a valid, and in fact the only valid direction. So that really surprised and upset me, and upsets me locally here as well, because we just started hydraulic fracturing over here in the UK, as if that was any kind of solution to anything.
Wow.
So, I mean, that's, yeah. So, I mean, even if we were to get 5 or 6 of the presidential nomination guys, or the 20 that are referenced in that Fox News article, I think it was, it very much comes down to the overarching attitude of politics towards the environment anyway. They could all have the wrong talking points, and your choices are still improved. It doesn't really matter. That's my two bits on that.
For sure. You know, and it's interesting you brought that up, and it makes me compelled to think about this. Is Romney, for example, is really appealing to the coal and oil lobby, And he's talking about, well, you know, these coal miners, they're worried they're going to lose their jobs. I mean, and this is kind of what brings me back to, and don't get me wrong, I don't want people to be unemployed, obviously, but at the same token, that's not a sustainable way to do things. And it's like, that brings us back to why we talk about we need to evaluate things from a scientific perspective and a rational perspective, rather than just politicians who are playing to whoever is there. You know, because unfortunately, it's not in the best interest of the world to keep using coal. It's not in the best interest of the world to keep using oil. It might be popular because there are people making money on it, including the people who are employed, but it doesn't make the right choice. You know, I mean, it's just, anyway, I'm sorry. Yes. Non-serving. Yeah, go ahead.
we're talking
about how people did it in the debates.
Excuse me, I did not see that one coming, and I had a mouthful of Blueberry Newton, which I highly recommend. And we have huckleberries around here. AG just made huckleberry syrup for pancakes. So,
awesome.
When Ray was talking about how anyone can get out there with their bare hands and start getting things done, yeah, you really can. You get huckleberry pancake syrup out of it. Yeah, I did I'm not going to paste the link in because that may have been what crashed my audio a minute ago. You can search for it on Bradblog, and it's a Romney company owns voting machines. And that's not even what I was really looking for, but it's a real case point. Ray said on a conversation I was having with him, Alex Jones said really well, too. You have no idea the kind of eggheads they have thinking about, you know, ways to enslave you. And it's really true. It's an obsession, a 24-hour obsession. How do we control the world? Like Pinky and the Brain. And the way you do that is you create a false dichotomy of voting in America. You take over the ownership of the machines and the media and the people who count the votes and stuff like that. And it's the same as any government ever was. But when my microphone dropped, I went through and I bookmarked a bunch of things. And when I came back, I went and looked. And I realized every single thing, basically, in my bookmarks in Firefox is a transhumanist link. It's about the singularity. It's about technology and artificial intelligence. There's nothing there about politics. Nothing. I think Ray got it right. He said, I barely pay attention to this stuff anymore. It's not the right solution. It's not even a solution. So, to me, it's a much more interesting question, or the same question, to say, like, who got into the club, or who got into the swimming pool, or who got into the ice cream, who got into the presidential debates? It's this club. The principle which drives the thing has nothing to do with exposing information to the people who are going to make votes in a rational way, or rather, the rationality comes from it. We don't want you voting. And it's just that simple. People need to understand the world they grew up in is a very old world, and it's had kings and emperors for a very long time. They never went away. And we can sit here and argue about how I'm going to vote for the puppet on the left is going to solve that problem, but it's not going to solve anything. It would be much wiser for people to focus on their own personal bottom lines, where they spend their money, how they relate to people, how they study and research and learn. And then run the state obsolete.
Right. Ray.
If I may just jump in very quickly, Chris.
Go ahead.
Yeah, Chris, you put up an extremely valid point there. The fact you said it's not even a solution. We can actually defer again to science on this. Science or scientists have a sort of a joke phrase to describe the religious attitudes towards the creation of the world or the explanations of anything. They said not even wrong. And I think that very much applies here as well. This whole shebang is not even incorrect. It's that irrelevant.
Right.
Well, good stuff, guys. Chris, thanks for all the kudos. I'll just continue that mantra where pretty much I hear and again all these things, all these assumptions, even this discussion. And we're certainly enlightened here, I have no doubt, a level or two above what the average driving 2-8-5 is thinking today. But we still got a ways to go in that. It's just that even ideas like talking about alternative technology, alternative fuels, as if there's somebody who is supposed to create alternative fuels for us. Talking about all these things as a science, as if there are some people that are supposed to go out and discover science for us, and that we are to mandate what they study, and we are to tell them how to study, and they are to come back and tell us some version of truth. I mean, all these things are foreign to me at this point in my life, in that I see the science that I need to understand, I see the technologies that relate to my life as something that can either make my life better, help me grow food, help me have shelter for my head, help me raise my family, help me educate my children, or they don't. And to the extent that they don't, I just don't care. If everybody would kind of start shifting into that paradigm and start realizing, let's take all these complex issues and tear them down and focus on the ones that really affect our lives in front of us, in the people that we relate to, in the community that we exist in. Let's take those issues that really mean something to the happiness of the people at that level, and let's see what we do about those things. Forget about all this stuff that's on TV and all this stuff that's happening in Washington, D.C. and at the UN. It's clear that kind of externalized thinking about concepts that are so far removed from the things that mean something to our happiness, they largely become nothing more than intellectual debate. And at that point, that intellectual debate, because it has no real meaning, we can go around in circles with each other endlessly debating about and largely it becomes definitional understandings, and nobody realizes that, so they go back and forth arguing until they're blue in the face about a political issue of one kind or the other, and not ever noticing in the whole thing that they have different definitional understandings of what they're talking about. They're talking right past each other anyway. And the reason that can happen, because it has no practical reality in their life. It's abstract. So, you know, my whole mantra is, it's time to reach the community, time to focus on what's really important. And yeah, it's time to start revising and start doing some things to go back to a simple way of life. Not that we're going to return to hunter-gatherer times or Little House on the Prairie times, or that I even want to see that happen. But I do want to see it happen to the extent that allows us to rethink how we organize with each other as human beings.
Well, Ray, I think that one of the reasons I do these shows, especially since there's so much attention being given to this issue, is try to bring people to the same conclusions that you're in now. You recognize why this isn't important, and one of the reasons why I analyze this is so that people understand why it isn't. And unfortunately, because most people are still under the spell of media when it comes to this sort of thing, it is still important to them. And the analysis is, especially when I do shows like these where we talk about these things that other people think are important, is to try to give people mental exercises to break their own personal matrix, so to speak, as far as the way the media, you know, makes this all look like serious business. That was like, for example, I bring up a lot of the lies that Romney says. And the funny thing is it's, you know, although, yeah, I've never liked Romney, it's not because I think that me doing that or, you know, that somehow maybe getting Obama elected would make anything better. I know better than that. But it's important only because most people don't even spend the time to analyze, fact check, and look into the fact that the guy lies as much as he does. It's like, the funny thing is that even for politicians, he's just going above and beyond. And he's got the Fox News echo chamber to just kind of justify all of his lies or spin them. And it's just insane how far he's willing to go. And what's been more insane is the different people, like I said earlier, this is the reason why it bothers me, was the lady that I talked to, you know, while I was sitting in a coffee shop watching TV, you know, who just is totally a Romney fan. And she looks like she's a smart person, but holy crap, you know, she was totally indoctrinated. And that's, I think, is that we have to remember that, you know, this show and a lot of the things that we do in the space movement and our other activist movements are not just for us, you know, not just for people who've reached that level already. They're for helping other people reach that same level.
I mean, so Nat, and I think you're doing a great job at kind of combining, Neil. So thank you. Keep it up. Keep inviting me on. I'm glad you do. Let's remind people of the simple truth that you don't achieve a major party nomination without having a proven track record of being a really great liar.
Well said.
That's very true. Right. Can I add something, Ray? It sounds like you either live on the land or you live in a place where you literally could have the resources to grow your own food and so on. Is that right?
Yeah, basically getting close to it.
Okay. Of course, your viewpoint is utterly valid if you have that sort of resource, if you have that sort of environment, if you like. One of the things that we spend a lot of time talking about in the Zeitgeist movement is these sort of larger scale technologies and larger scale advances. And the reason we hold those valid is because a huge amount of people don't have the kind of resources or know-how that you do, and they live in massive cities. And those cities, for example, just to take cities, would have to be re-engineered in a more communal way rather than in a sort of an individualistic way in order for them to actually work properly or well. For example, farming. Without many people, can't all grow food in their back garden all year round. So that's some of the reason why I talk about technology the way I do, and I think probably one of the reasons why you don't, because you have a different environment. And actually, I'm actually quite jealous of you. I had, for example, a garden in which I could do that. At the moment, I'm looking at three small pots that I'm growing chilies in, and that's about it that I can do. So, I mean, that's why we have some of that focus. Is that some of the solutions we talk about might seem a little bit irrelevant to you, but that's because we have also got larger problems with millions, if not, I mean, in China, there's a mega city that now has 1 billion people in it. What would we do technologically about that? How would we re-engineer agriculture to be sort of in the cities rather than really far outside the cities and all the rest of it? So that's why some of these talking points might come up.
Good stuff. I mean, yeah, and good. At least you are even starting to think about growing some stuff, and Chris might be able to speak a little back to it, because they've undertaken from scratch getting to the point they're at, you know, within the span of the little bit in the last 6 or 9 months. So I mean, anybody can do it if they decide that's what they're going to do. Also, I think that I'm all for communal based understandings. That I see that my studies have indicated to me that in order to achieve a true consensus among a group of people, one, that group has to be small, like 10 people or less. Two, it takes a very deep understanding of the spiritual aspects. It takes a very selfless analysis of self, removal of ego, appreciation of differences, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. These are all things that are missing in today's interactions with people. So until we break it down into people relearning those skills, which are the most natural skills that are within us, I believe, you know, when you're forced to wake up every day and look at the 6, 9, or 10 people that you have to live with that day, you're going to learn to get along. You're going to start taking a hard look at yourself. You're going to learn to appreciate them, or else your life is going to be miserable in conflict. And only going through that process at that direct human interact level, I think that we ever start to figure out how we can then take what we've learned from it and start building larger political systems. And I'm only saying that while I'm totally fans of what Venus Project, Zeitgeist Movement, what they're trying to accomplish, I hope they succeed. But what I keep seeing in it is that in order for them to succeed, they're going to have to have people come to all these realizations I just mentioned about how to get along with each other and such. And to me, I don't see how that's going to happen unless people greatly change their lifestyle. So it's kind of like 22 thing. But I totally respect all those projects and your perspective on that, Ben.
I'm glad actually we had that exchange. We are getting a bit off topic. so I mean, go ahead and make a reply if you needed to, Ben, and then we'll move forward.
Absolutely. I essentially find myself agreeing with Ray. It is both, funnily enough. It's almost yin and yang, which seems like a catch-22, is that gradually, as all these pressures are going to mount, gradually as people realize that this stuff is irrelevant, as you say, Ray, that's when they, I think, first will retreat inward, will reevaluate what they have, and the mechanism for reevaluation would be scientific. That's almost exactly what you were sort of saying with, like, looking those people in the eye, understanding them. It's coming to a sort of a selfless understanding. That is sort of as effective as you can get. So I do agree. That is a genetic part of the whole project, I think. Yeah.
And we actually
can I
go ahead.
real quick, and for any duality like a yin-yang, let's make it a trinity, you know. It's pleasing to hear Ray talk your line from the North Georgia Patriots, Neil. I guess he finally found his inner hippie, because some people do really appreciate, you know, hanging out with your family and watching the grandkids stumble around the yard. And, maybe we can all go and do hula hoops or something like that. But I got to tell you, I had a good upbringing. I have a lovely family. I don't want to spend every day with them. I would much rather go to the lab and conduct science with my time. And it's very, very, very important to remember, not everyone wants to be a happy little docile sheep sitting on their 1 acre land farming tomatoes. I'll do it because it sustains the meat body. But I am interested in ideas and progress and technology. And if Ray's vision, his many steps at the lab, extends to, I'm going to sit at home. Well, maybe there's a few more steps beyond that, where I say, I'm going to go exploring. I would much rather be out there learning new things than sitting back here revisiting the past. And that is a fundamental drive of humanity that isn't going away, no matter how much people believe, for their own reasons, that it would be better if everything were nice and comfy. I'm sorry.
I understand that completely. It's one of the reasons why Ben and I advocate the eventuality that we'll be able to automate these kinds of farms, you know, and systems that we need to take care of ourselves, so we will have more time for that exploration. Hold on one second. Just I want to say we have a caller on the line, and I'm going to take the call. I just don't want them to think I'm ignoring them. So go ahead and make your last point, Ray.
Okay. Yeah, totally agree. What I'm saying is only the very start of, I think, what needs to happen next. It certainly is not, we're not talking, like I said before, I'm not suggesting returning to everybody working in the dirt and living off the land at all. It's just, it may be we have to get close to that before we can really start to restructure economic and political system that makes some kind of sense. And with the technology we have, it really should be that the tasks of the basics of survival of food and shelter really ought to take anybody an hour of their time and investment and energy of any given day to have everything they need, and for everybody to have everything they need, if we have functioning political and economic systems. That's what I'm saying, and I think we kind of need that as a first step.
All right, cool. Well, let me see what the caller has to say. Caller Nip Farmer, you are on the air.
Hey guys, how you doing? We're working to solve a lot of these problems, and we could solve them, but the powers that be, some of these things, I don't think they really want them solved. Read an article the other day where, not an article, where they tried to pass a law in Congress. It was H.R. 875-425-S. It'd be against the law to raise your own food, store up a supply of food, share food, give away food, or save seeds. What kind of son of a bitch would put something through that, like try to make it law?
You know, it's interesting. Go ahead. Tell her name and where you at.
My name's Neil from Alabama.
Oh, hey. My name's Neil from Michigan. Yeah,
okay.
I know what you're talking about regarding legislation, and there are people who are concerned about that. So it's interesting to see the way they crack down on some of these stores, you know, that have, like, food in them and stuff. I don't know if you remember the video they had, California raw food store. It got raided with, like, gunpowder as if they were showing up to, you know, crack a cocaine cartel or something.
Yeah.
So, you get an interesting point. I think that at the end of the day, it's still going to come to us, you know, needing that knowledge.
Well,
because if there's going to be any form of collapse, or if there's going to be any form of unrest, we need to be in a position to be able to take care of ourselves. So, once again, we want to say we're off topic. So go ahead and make your closing statement. I want to thank you
for
making it.
Well, closing statement just being that we can fix it. If we have the right people in office that aren't snuggled up to industry. For instance, out in California, there's a company out there. They're building a greenhouse, and everything's inside the greenhouse, including bees and everything else. They raise 20 times the amount of food on 1 acre of ground by having a building cover in it and regulating it and everything inside versus just having it out in the open. So there's no shortage of food unless somebody wants there not to be any shortage of food. That's it. Thanks.
No, excellent. And thank you very much for calling in. So, going back here now, it's excellent that he pointed that out, and we are going to be looking at a position where obviously eventually anything that is a threat to the establishment's hold will be something that will eventually be called into, basically called into question, that there will be people out there that will try to stop us from doing it. And I've heard rumblings about that. You certainly see it about, for example, the legalization of marijuana, which has a lot of medicinal purposes, and the way that they dumped all over that and the way the feds will show up in states where it's legal to grow it. Personal use, and they'll still crack on you even though the local state laws permit it. Those are just things to be looking at here in the future. I think at the end of the day, though, knowledge is going to be the key. The fact that we have this knowledge, and it's one of the reasons why, it's important that we get this knowledge before we get a chance. And as the cop pointed out, it would probably help if we didn't have politicians who were in bed that way. I do think that we will start, doing a lot better as far as changing any of that kind of paradigm if we do so on a grassroots level, but be ready for the possibility that politicians won't be in a position to help us. So moving on to the next part of this, I was given this actually last night, and I had originally thought I was going to do a show after the day, but I was too tired and decided to go to bed. But as far as people who are having problems getting into the debate and people who have issues with debate, Jill Stein of the Green Party actually went to the debates, the location of the debates was outside in protest alongside her vice presidential candidate, and this is what she had to say. Hopefully the sound quality will be better on this clip than the last one.
Yeah, please, not on the side of the road
first. Good job, you got to move back a little bit. You've been run over by a car.
Move over the line over. Is over. Just for a minute while she makes a phone call, we just need to slide over.
Right over here.
Well, we're here to stand our ground. We're here to stand ground for the American people who have been systematically locked out of these debates for decades by the Commission on Presidential Debates. We think that this commission is entirely illegitimate, that if democracy truly prevailed, there would be no such commission, that the debates would still be run by the League of Women Voters, that the debates would be open with the criteria that the League of Women Voters had always used, which was that if you have done the work to get on the ballot, if you are on the ballot and could actually win the Electoral College by being on the ballot in enough states, that you deserve to be in the election and you deserve to be heard, and that the American people actually deserve to hear choices which are not bought and paid for by multinational corporations and Wall Street. This is why we are not hearing the critical issues in this debate. Where are young people in this debate, in this election? You'd think that the younger generation must be public enemy number one for all the bandwidth and all the attention that young people are receiving in this debate. How about those 36 million students and recent graduates who are effectively indentured servants because they are carrying around unforgiving, horrendous debt, specially customized for students so that there's no way you can get out of that debt. It will follow you around. It will garner your wages. Bankruptcy will not protect you. This is special student debt brought to you by a corporate-sponsored Congress. Where is the attention to the plight of these young people carrying that debt, facing a 50% unemployment and underemployment rate, unable to pay back that debt? Where is the issue of skyrocketing costs of public higher education? Where's the solution? The solution, in fact, is that we could be providing free public higher education. We did that after the Second World War in the GI Bill. For every dollar that the taxpayer put into public higher education, $7 was returned to the economy. This is absolutely the right thing to do instead of bailing out the banks. The fourth bailout is going on right now to the tune of $40 billion a month through this QE3, Quantitative Easing 3. We're not going to hear about that in the debate. We're not going to hear about the fact that all the other bailouts so far,
$4.5 trillion in money disbursed, $16 trillion in free loans given to the big banks. That in spite of that, the crisis goes on. The banks are still too big to fail, too big to jail. It's time for the American people to hear about the solutions that can really fix this problem and to hear about the candidates that they have the right to vote for.
Well, that was a great clip of Jill Stein. Actually, one of the reasons for the quality in that was that it was taken by somebody's camera and put up to YouTube. So I got to put my hats off, essentially, to the independent media that covered that issue that was largely being ignored, obviously, by everyone else. Now, there were a couple of brief articles that I wanted to put on that. But, you know, just once again saying, you know, it's like, what would be the motive of being people like this out of the debate? She had a lot of good stuff to say, and it's certainly not the kind of stuff that you want, you know, that the mainstream would want heard. You know, there was a lot of things that both sides agreed not to do. There was actually an article up recently about how there was some kind of debate agreement between the Democrats and the Republicans. And a kind of a rules of engagement, so to speak, limiting how they would approach one another. So there were two articles, actually, not very long articles, were searched at jillstein.org, which is the campaign website for Jill Stein. Jill Stein, Sherry Hankala arrested, calling tonight's debate a mockumentary. They were arrested shortly after that speech you just heard. Jill Stein and Sherry Hankala, the Green presidential and vice presidential nominees, were now forcibly prevented from entering the grounds of tonight's presidential debate organized by the Commission on Presidential Debates. Dr. Stein and Ms. Hankala will appear on 85% of the ballots on election day and recently polled 2-3% for consecutive national polls. The federal government recognizes Jill Stein as a qualified presidential candidate, having approved her campaign federal matching funds. Yet two women were arrested by local police when they tried to enter the grounds of Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York, where the debate is scheduled to take place. Obviously, this went on last night. They are currently still in police custody. There's an update that will be read next. But Dr. Stein and Ms. Hankala walked toward the Hofstra campus at 2 p.m. Eastern today, yesterday. We were there met by three ranks of police officers in uniform and plainclothes. At this point, the party candidates held an impromptu press conference in which Dr. Stein called the CP debate a mockumentary, saying that we are here to bring the courage of those excluded from our politics to mock debate. This is a mockery of democracy. Now, this is the update dated today. Free Stein and Hankala pledged to wrap up the fight for open debates. Jill Stein and Sherry Hankala are now free from police custody after 8 hours handcuffed to a metal chair in a remote police warehouse on Long Island. The Green Party presidential and vice presidential candidates were arrested early today as they attempted to enter the grounds of today's presidential debate. News of the incident spread quickly around the world via media coverage carried on ABC, The Wall Street Journal, The Washington Post, Democracy Now!, and many other channels, as well as via social media, trending on Twitter, for example, as far away as Egypt. On her release, Dr. Stein said that it was painful, symbolic to be handcuffed for all those hours Commission on Presidential Debates is essentially done to American democracy. Stein and Hankala were eventually released into cold at 10:30 p.m. Police provided no advance notice of the risk to campaign lawyers and staff and did not allow the two candidates to make any phone calls. That's, like, illegal. Sherry Hankala called her incarceration extremely uncomfortable, but standard for what so many Americans face on a daily basis in our correction system. Added Stein campaign manager Ben Mansky, these arrests and this treatment are outrageous and proportionate. What do the police think they are protecting here? You know, it's fun is that Jill Stein is, you know, a mature, small woman. Her vice presidential candidate is also, you know, a small, diminutive woman. I cannot imagine how they would be so dangerous that they needed to be handcuffed for 8 hours. But I also can't say that I'm really all that surprised. It sounded to me like, you know, things like this when they happen are kind of a message to you that are meant to, you know, it's meant to be intimidating. If you haven't done anything that's actually illegal, you know, they'll lock you up for a while because they're hoping that you will be less likely to, you know, to do the same kind of protest again later. So I'm going to open up, you know, just comments here and also kind of open the floor a little bit once again for, you know, Ben's unique perspective, being how the Green Party, I guess, is a little more successful in England. And I know they're also more successful in Australia. You know, you guys, you know, you said, Ben, that, for example, this is the first time that you guys, or recently anyways, the first time guys have had some debates. You know, what do you think about this? You know, this candidate shows up to the debate. Obviously, she wasn't going to be able to participate, but they were ready to arrest her before she got to the building.
Yeah, it's become a depressing, expected effect, basically. I mean, and it's actually extremely valuable. I actually see this very differently. It's actually a wonderful thing that's what they did, because it reminds you of how power is exercised, right? You don't have to appeal to any conspiracy theories anymore, do you? And it's exactly the same with what happened with Occupy in America as well. This wonderful movement, this huge expression, this, you know, synchronistic sort of effect. How do they do it? Well, they bring out UC Davis, they bring out the 0.8 pepper spray that's what you use on bears, and then, of course, when they start talking about the really important issues like, I don't know, Delaware Corporation founding and all the rest of it, that's when the truncheons come out. Thank you, we're not going to have that conversation. Off you go, and they're paying you to a metal chair. Everything you said is extremely important, and I would probably for her not even knowing her other positions based on what she just said. Education could be free. You know, you can make the case that it should be or not, but it actually could be. It could technically be free. And it could be lifelong. It could be continual throughout your life, so that, you know, if you ever had to or needed to or wanted to change your direction, you would be so educated and could get the education quickly and effectively that you could actually do that. The fact that there's all that massive money being printed, but it's not being printed and created as numbers, that is systematically devaluing the money that already exists, and, you know, of course, just only getting out as loans essentially every time the QEs come around. All it means more borrowing, more debt, more servitude, and a worse future. It's very, very refreshing to hear that, and it's such a nice, precise, clear, well-spoken way. And, you know, the fact that they got arrested, they should be proud of, because it does remind the average American and the average Brit, we have similar things going on here as well, that this is how they deal with you when they don't want to hear from you. It's not asking you politely to leave. It's to brand you a criminal in spite of the law. Neil, you said that was illegal, that they didn't allow her to make a phone call. Well, it was illegal. Who cares about that? This doesn't serve our purposes. We don't want you speaking to the media. In fact, we don't want them speaking to the media so much, we're going to release you randomly so that no one's ready to actually take or listen to your things. So I wouldn't have heard about this if there wasn't social media, like you pointed out as well. It's quite an impressive episode.
Ray.
Kudos to Jill. I'm not sure that I would agree all her politics, as she's probably talking about things that would require me to contribute to this large federal or global idea she has. But what she's doing at the ground level, that kind of action, is absolutely wonderful, and I'm glad to see her do it. And I wish. Gary Johnson would never dream of doing something like that. He would think that would make him look, probably unpresidential or something would be his approach to that. And as much as I'm a fan of all third party candidates, Gary Johnson and Jill of the Green Party, Gary Johnson of the Libertarian Party, of course, and the several others that I haven't done the research to know about who are certainly making their bid, I encourage everybody to give these people the respect they deserve and give them your vote, because that sends an important message all around to the powers that be, as well as to the other people in this country. As they see those numbers go down for the Republicans, and they see the numbers start to increase for other parties, it just sends an important message. So definitely kudos to Jill.
Chris?
Resident futurist, I suppose. First, I'd like to tell everyone there's a documentary out there basically about why Jill Stein was allowed in, called Who's Afraid of an Open Debate? Much like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf or something like that. Who's Afraid of an Open Debate? Your panel is filled with intelligent people, and you nailed it. They want to limit the scope of the thing that gets discussed. And more significantly than what they're keeping out, is what they're keeping in, you know, that it's going to be a Romney-Obama paradigm, which is hysterical because they're carbon copies of each other. But I wanted to bring up another thing, which is the Pirate Party, they're affiliated with the Pirate Bay, which is where the name came from. The Pirate Bay just got rid today, or yesterday, got rid of every land-based server they have, jurisdictional server that they have. The Pirate Bay, which is the largest BitTorrent site in the world, is now completely virtualized in the cloud, all on Amazon and various different cloud servers, hundreds of different providers in hundreds of different territories. And in experience with the WikiLeaks debacle about the time of collateral murder, Pirate Party, Iceland, and all of the people involved with that, which was a very informative time, I gotta admit, comes back to the idea of who's moving forward into the potential capabilities of technology and who's in the past. You want to, you know, there's a party out there, say the Constitution Party, you know, hey, by the way, Jill, welcome to Chuck Baldwin and every third party candidate ever getting kicked out of a debate. They just decided to arrest you them for the show of it. You know, Chuck Baldwin was the Constitution Party. Well, the Constitution's an interesting 200-something-year-old document, and I'm not sure it really makes a difference to the Pirate Bay and Iceland and a bunch of these people who were extraordinarily active in technology, networking, and encryption, whether or not, you know, we apply this particular legal framework to this particular chunk of real estate. So Jill's act, then, is a lot more symbolic than practical, and if the Green Party does want to incorporate Ray's view of what I do, you know, all of the good environmental stuff they've been working on for a long time, they need to move it into a way where it's tough to censor them, where they're debating in other places, where they're influencing people beyond the scope of this jurisdiction. And, you know, I think that's actually seeing it happen, because here's a YouTube documentary on Reddit, and there's the video of her getting arrested, and she had a statement prepared for it. That's kind of more modern approach to this media cycle and media environment that will work for activists like the ones who listen to the show.
Yep, I agree. Now, that was basically pretty much everything I had for today. I just wanted to, and I know that some guys, you know, obviously had to go, and we did go a little longer than I thought, but I want to give everybody an opportunity, especially, you know, Ben, I know you have a lot of great stuff that you do on your own. You've hosted some of the global radio shows, and you've done great lectures and stuff. Do you have any kind of central hub or internet presence that people who are listening who maybe haven't checked out more of your work can see it?
Yeah, this is a good question, isn't it? I suppose the first one I have is, if you search my name, Ben McLeish, S-E-L-E-I-S-H, on Vimeo, that tends to be the place where I upload most of my stuff. I'm going to have a pro account, though, because I've got a new interview. It's not new, about a year old now. It's just sent to me in long form. It's 80 megabytes over Vimeo's free allowance, Baron. So that'll be coming out at some point. But yeah, Vimeo is probably one of the ones. I also have a blog on the Zeitgeist Movement UK. .com as well, which I pop in every now and again. So, of course, you can find me on Facebook. I have an official page on there as well.
All right, awesome. Now, I talked a little bit that, you know, Chris has done some in the past and Ray has done some in the past. And neither of you guys have any active current, though, right?
Well, actually, we were just talking about the very things we do have active, and because you brought it up. You're talking about bringing a bunch of the media people we've met together on one roof. It's a fascinating idea, and I'd be happy to participate in it, but I want to plug something else. I got memefilter.info, and you go to /blog. It's one of my blogs. And ironically, I polluted it. It's supposed to be music and ideas, and it had been all ideas until recently, where I put in a post that I found on Reddit about engineering electric guitars, of all things. You know, I stopped broadcasting a lot because it takes a lot of time, and I had been talking news and analysis, and it's interesting, and you know, great audience of people who are really, really sharp and on top of the world works. But I wanted to stop and do something a little different for a while. And so I started working on this concept called Temetics, or technology memes. If you're familiar with memetics and Rich Hawkins, Susan Blackmore, and that whole line that ideas are replicators and we're the hosts, which is a fascinating line of reason. So I'd encourage everyone to go over there and read through the very thick technical prose to describe his work progress, the thematic theory, which explains how technology will change humanity in irreversible ways, and there's no sense to complain about it, and until you get your definition straight, you won't be able to do anything except for a lag behind the curve. But once you flip your thinking, then it's all up. It's a brave new world of technological capabilities that you can acquire for yourself if only you change how you think.
And they can check that out. You know, you said that memefilterinfo?
/ blog.
All right, excellent. And Ray, are you working on anything right now?
Yeah, let's go ahead and plug the Natural Rights Foundation.org because of anything that I'm interested in seeing where it goes right at the moment. It's that because that's the bottom line. It's in order to solve many of these greater issues, people are really going to have to start come back to a simpler understanding of simple things that nobody can disagree with. That's principle non-aggression principle, however you want to say it. So Natural Rights Foundation is basically taking that principle and applying it to various basics of what we look at in society today as norms, and just gives you learning that foundational aspect of thinking will give us ways to solve all kinds of problems. NaturalRightsFoundation.org.
Yeah, actually, it's ironic that you put that up because Aaron – Stormcloud's Gathering just contacted me because he was my available. We're going to be doing an episode of E-Radio where we're just talking about the Natural Rights Foundation, and I hope all of you guys who are on the call, and I actually need to ask you about it as well, Ben, and we could do that sometime off the air. You know, it sounds like it's going to be a great project. It's kind of a melding pot, so to speak, for activists of different groups to kind of get together on the things that they actually agree about, to have meaningful dialogue. You know, when we can kind of get together and share our ideas in a, you know, in a place where the culture of that place is in such a way to facilitate good communication of ideas, concepts. And I've already enjoyed some of the conferences we've had so far. You know, so remember, though, when you check that out, I mean, the Natural Rights Foundation, you're going to talk to some people you don't agree with absolutely on everything. You're going to talk to some people you do agree with. So it's not just zeitgeist-oriented. It's not libertarian-oriented. It's not anarchist-oriented. You know, in fact, it's kind of designed to not be any of those things, but welcome all of those people. So just something to think about here for the future, naturalrightsfoundation.org. So that's all I had for V Radio today. I'm actually, you know, as you just said, we're going to be on the Natural Rights Foundation. I'm still working on an interview with Jill Stein. I'm also working on an interview with someone who is a former employee and whistleblower for Monsanto Corporation. We'll be on a future episode of V Radio. And one thing to remind everybody, V Radio, I'm going to try to do every day. Do me a favor and give me a hand. You know, if you see any piece of news that you think is relevant to the activist perspective that you would like to see talked about in these kinds of roundtable discussions of people from, you know, various walks of life and from around the world, please, you know, link those articles to me. You can find my Facebook group, Fan V Radio, by going to my website, V-radio.org, and clicking links. Fans of V Radio is a good way to get a hold of me. Skype is a good way to get a hold of me. You know, and if you find any links that you think would be good for news, please don't hesitate to share them. I'm going to lay us out with a George Carlin quote. I'm going to warn you guys who are listening or accustomed once again to no profanity that Mr. Carlin is one of the individuals who allows me to do a little bit of cussing. So the name of this video is kind of a compilation of different things that George has said, and it's the illusion of choice.
The Americans seem to think that the party's going to last forever, and the holiday goes on and on, and they don't really see the error of certain things. I mean, Thomas Rainsford Lounsbury was an educator in the 19th century, and he said, "It never ceases to surprise me at the infinite capacity of the human mind to resist the introduction of useful knowledge." And that's what it is. People know better. People sense better. But they go against it. They just think there are no consequences.
It kills me that
it's a steady downhill slide. You know, this country is really finished. I mean, it really is technically finished. It's just a matter of playing out the end game. Well, that's true. It's true. You can see it. You can smell it. Anyone who can't see it or smell it doesn't understand.
Yeah.
There's a medical term that they use in hospitals when a person has no future left on this planet. They can't be helped anymore. And they put it on the chart, CTD, circling the drain. And that's what we're doing. We're slowly circling the drain, and the circles get smaller, and they get faster. I enjoy it. Personally, I don't have a stake in the outcome.
Right.
I personally enjoy this circus that I've been invited to. I've often said when you're born in the world, you're given a ticket to the freak show. When you're born in America, you're given a front row seat, and I couldn't enjoy it more.
I'm talking about the fact that a war is old men protecting their property by sending young men, or rich old men protecting their property by sending middle class and lower class young men off to die. It always has been. It's all about owning things. All of this back and forth and debate implies that there are really choices in this country, that we really have choices, freedom of choice.
Well, it's an
illusion.
Army.
Americans are made, and they're having trouble filling the slots in this all-volunteer army. I wonder why.
Well, raise the pay of the morning.
Let me say one thing about choice. There is no real choice. They say freedom of choice. You're given an illusion of choice. Americans are meant to feel free by the exercise of meaningless choices. You don't have, you know what
right.
the choices are in this country? Paper or plastic, a pile or window, smoking or non-smoking. Those are your real choices. You began a sentence a little while ago with it's not a surprise. It shouldn't be a surprise. It shouldn't be a surprise that rich white men don't care about poor black people, period. So they're not high on their list. They're not high on their list.
George,
they're
I love
not
you,
high.
George,
they're not.
That's
I don't
nonsense.
Care if you love me or not.
That's
they're not
nonsense.
High on the conscious or the
no,
subconscious list of those people who are in charge of things in this country. The owners, forget these foolish elections. The owners of this country don't care about the poor in general.
The owners
and
of
they
this
don't
country.
Care about
what are we going? Is this Karl Marx talking to me? The owners of this country are
no.
the voters of this country.
You're wrong about that, my friend.
Aren't the owners
wrong.
Of this country the voters in this country
no,
who
no,
elected
they're,
George
no,
Bush?
Not. Listen, politics, these elections are a charade. It is a charade.
Oh, okay.
It is. They are meant to... Well, I'll tell you, listen, just listen for a minute. Learn a little something. The elections and politicians are in place in order to give Americans the illusion that they have freedom of choice. You don't really have choice in this country. I have an addendum to that. The real looting in this country takes place in the transfer of the wealth from the poor to the rich. I'm sorry that you don't like class and the truth, my friend, but you're just stuck with it. And the poor have been systematically looted in this country. The rich have been made richer under this criminal, fascist president and his government.
George, I think you know. Do you know what fascism is?
Fascism,
you know what fascism
when it comes
is.
To America, it
you know what Nazis
wear, it
are.
Not wear, no, wait,
yeah.
sir. Wait,
you
sir. When fascism
are,
comes
you know
to America, it will
are.
Not be in brown and black shirts. It will not be with jack boots. It will be Nike sneakers and smiley shirts. Smiley. The fascism. Germany lost the Second World War. Fascism won it. Believe
and actually,
me, my friend.
George, you think is that looting mind, is looting okay if there's no hurricane?
First of all, property.
Can you break into tweeters
but
whenever you want?
We're talking
I
about
have no problem with theft. May I be honest?
No
with
problem
you?
With
I have
theft.
No problem with theft. True.
Well, George is defending looting, but
I have no. I have no stake in the outcome.
I think
you have to give him credit for one thing. You have to give him credit.
They're
out in the open now. They're out in the open now. They're not even trying to conceal it anymore. The owners of the country got their election. They said, we're going to get this election. We put you people in that court for a reason.
All right.
Now
back
the time
to earth
us.
For you
and
now.
Yeah, forget all that stupid. Will you? They're out in the open. They're openly driving the bus, and we're all in the back.
It's because of the energy policies that were created here in California, not as a result of a conspiracy, but because...
You don't need a formal conspiracy when interests converge. These people went to the same universities and fraternities. They're on the same boards of directors. They're in the same country clubs. They have like interests. They don't need to call a meeting. They know what's good for them, and they're getting it. And there used to be seven oil companies. There are
are now three. It will soon be two. The things that matter in this country have been reduced in choice. There are two political parties. There are a handful of insurance companies. There are about six or seven information things. But if you want a bagel, there are 23 flavors because you have the illusion. You have the illusion of choice.
Right.
You don't get the real important stuff. There's no freedom of choice.
That's a great point.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.